From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. More than a dozen large wildfires are still burning in California, charring at least 320,000 acres and displacing 32,000 residents so far. Meanwhile, a heat wave continues across much of Europe. Temperatures as high as 118 degrees Fahrenheit are expected in southwestern Spain tomorrow. We'll see if 2018 eclipses 2017, which was the third warmest year ever recorded, behind 2016 and 2015. Michael Mann joins us now. He's director of the Earth System Science Center at Penn State University. Professor, welcome back.
Thanks. Great to be with you.
And when you hear about all of those extreme weather events that are going on, can you make a direct link between those and climate change?
In a sense, yes. They're all interconnected. What we're seeing right now across the Northern Hemisphere is extreme weather in the form of unprecedented heat waves, droughts, floods, wildfires. In isolation, it might seem like any one of these things could be dismissed as an anomaly, but it's the interconnectedness of all these events and their extreme nature that tells us that we are now seeing the face of climate change. The impacts of climate change are no longer subtle. We are seeing them play out in real time in the form of unprecedented and dangerous weather events.
But I must say, when I've done interviews about extreme weather events with meteorologists, with scientists, and I ask them, is this hurricane climate change? They're very careful not to say, well, they would say, well, we can't say that this one is in particular, but when we see, when you look at the big picture, yes, it probably is part of a trend. Should scientists and meteorologists be more specific and say, yes, each one of these things is a result of climate change?
Yeah, it's sort of answering the wrong question. When we frame the issue in terms of was this event caused by climate change, that's not the right question. The question is, was this event made more extreme by climate change? And that we can conclude with some certainty because there's basic physics that's operating here. A warmer atmosphere holds more moisture. That means when you get rainfall, you get more of it in short bursts. As you bake the ground with sun and heat, you're going to get worse drought. As you warm up the planet, obviously heat extremes become more common. And now there are some subtleties here as well, because part of what has made this July so unusual is not just the extreme nature of these events, but their persistence. The same weather system sticks around day after day, so you continue to get dumped on by rain like we are here in central Pennsylvania, or you continue to be baked by heat like California right now. That pattern in the jet stream, that is favored by climate change. And our own work has shown that the melting of ice in the Arctic is changing temperature patterns in a way that is impacting the Northern Hemisphere jet stream, causing larger waves, larger meanders, which gives you more extremes.
And climate scientists and others are saying the world has to do something about this or it's going to get even worse. But there's an article in New York Magazine called How Did the End of the World Become Old News? And in it, the writer Davis Wallace Wells writes, the major networks aired 127 segments on the unprecedented July heat wave. Media Matters usefully tabulated and only one so much as mentioned climate change. What do you make of that? Do reporters, do journalists have to continually say this is climate change, this is climate change, or are we losing sight of what's going on?
Yeah, and let me preface my comments here by saying there's some shining counterexamples like NPR and WBUR. There are media outlets and there are journalists who are helping us connect the dots. But too often, you know, in sort of our mainstream media and network news coverage, cable news, they're not connecting the dots and explaining that this isn't just a random event. It's part of a coherent, larger pattern which is being impacted, which is being influenced, which is being made more frequent and more intense by climate change. That's a huge lost opportunity because this is the face of climate change. And we have to understand it's not just about polar bears up in the Arctic. It's about extreme, damaging weather events that we are experiencing now in real time.
I want to say one more thing, which is that we just did an interview the other day about some of the extreme weather going on. We did not, in the four-minute conversation, even though we talked about the fires in Greece and we talked about the fires in California and we talked about the wet weather in the east coast of this country, we did not make a direct link to climate change. And somebody wrote to me and said, you're part of a mass conspiracy to not talk about climate change. I assure you, nothing could be further from the truth. But, does it need to be brought up in every conversation, do you think?
Yeah, shame on you. No, I'm just kidding.
Sorry.
No, you know, it's easy to forget that context because we live in the here and now and in the moment, especially in, you know, in the, you know, the rapid pace of the news cycle, we lose sight of the larger context. It doesn't mean we have to talk about climate change every time we talk about the weather, but when there's something unusual enough that it does call into question, you know, why is this happening? There's, you know, a huge learning opportunity for your audience in bringing that climate context into the conversation. And if we leave it out, then it is a lost opportunity.
That's Michael Mann, a distinguished professor of atmospheric science and director of the Earth System Science Center at Penn State. Professor Mann, thanks as always.
Thank you. Always a pleasure.
Well, we do live in the here and now, and perhaps no profession has had to deal with this question more than TV meteorologists. And now four U.S. senators are raising objections about a program partially funded by the National Science Foundation that teaches TV forecasters about climate change. Ali Budner from member station KRCC reports.
Mike Nelson adjusts his earpiece and lapel mic and strides onto a small black stage in front of a bright green screen. The cameras are rolling.
Thanks, Chris. Take a look at the smoke from the fire down in the Sangre de Cristo Mountains. I mentioned last time about the heat as our climate continues to change. This is a graphic from Climate Central.
He points to a chart with a red background and the words "more hot summer days" at the top. It shows in a graph that on average over the last 50 years, temperatures keep going up.
Year to year, but the trend clearly is that we're seeing more and more hot days. With the heat comes more drought. With the drought comes more dry forests. With the dry forests comes more forest fires. Right now, this is what it looks like.
Nelson has been in the weather business for four decades, and he's chief meteorologist at the ABC television affiliate in Denver. He's part of a growing trend in TV, putting daily weather forecasts in the context of global warming. The graphic he just used was from the group Climate Central.
A graphic like that, I could draw myself, but it's really, you're busy. You got a lot of stuff going on. It's great when you can go to their library, find something, you just drop in.
Climate Central is a nonprofit, partially funded by government grants, that aims to educate the public about global warming. One of their programs trains TV weathercasters like Mike Nelson in the science of climate change and in the art of communicating about it. Bernadette Woods Plackey directs Climate Central's broadcaster training program called Climate Matters.
We give them data and scientific information on how climate change is impacting their community.
Since 2012, she says their network has grown from 30 broadcasters to more than 500. That's nearly a quarter of the total number of TV weathercasters in the country. Woods Plackey is a veteran TV meteorologist herself.
What I have learned in my career is that we are informing our public about what's going to happen to them. We're preparing them.
But there's a different take out there on what Climate Matters is up to. In a recent joint letter, Republican Senators Rand Paul, James Inhofe, Ted Cruz, and James Lankford argued that the nonprofit is engaging in partisan activity or, quote, climate action-oriented opinion and shouldn't get federal funding because of it. Inhofe is a well-known climate change skeptic.
On record, I asked the chair, you know what this is? It's a snowball.
Here he is several years ago on the Senate floor using a snowball as a prop to trivialize global warming.
And that's just from outside here. So it's very, very cold out, very unseasonal. So here, Mr. President, catch this.
Inhofe and the other senators are calling on the National Science Foundation's Inspector General to open an investigation. They're arguing that an NSF grant that helps fund Climate Matters violates the Hatch Act. That act prohibits federal employees from getting involved in political activities. None of the four senators were available for comment, except to say that their letter speaks for itself. But Climate Central's Woods Plackey doesn't buy it.
Science is science is science. The scientific evidence of climate change is not political.
97% or more of the world's scientists agree, as does the American Meteorological Society and Denver meteorologist Mike Nelson.
The physics doesn't care about the politics.
Still, he knows there's a political war raging over the words climate change and what they represent. So it's a fine line, one that he says he has no trouble walking, but he says his 40 years in the business gives him some cover.
And so if you're a 30-year-old weathercaster with a couple of little kids, you've been in the market for 2 years, you're like, geez, I better back off. I got to keep my job.
Yeah, it's a very fine line that you need to walk, especially for someone like me.
Justin Roth is a 28-year-old TV meteorologist at a local station in Casper, Wyoming. He says he recently reported a news story about wildfires in Wyoming and how they may be getting worse.
Certainly got some pushback as well, and people basically saying, oh, you can't predict the weather in the next week. How are you going to predict the weather in 20 years?
Roth says he occasionally checks the Climate Matters website so he can keep up professionally with the science on global warming, but
I'm not going to go out of my way to talk about climate change on air here in Wyoming than maybe I would in a different part of the country, just because of the conservative mindset of this audience.
That's something Denver meteorologist Mike Nelson wants to help his colleagues figure out, because he believes climate change is a solvable crisis.
We can do this, but you don't solve very many problems without admitting you have one.
The National Science Foundation's Inspector General says they'll be assessing the issues the senators raised in their letter this fall. For Here and Now, I'm Allie Butner.
Someone always had to be the first of their people to come to America, but this next story isn't one of exploration, it's of exploitation. The first Chinese woman, maybe the first Asian woman to ever set foot on U.S. soil, was probably 14-year-old A Fang Moy, brought by American traders in 1834, displayed in a New York museum, and called the Chinese lady. People came to gawk at her bound feet. What must she have thought? Well, that's the premise of a new play.
Hello. My name is A Fang Moy. It is the year 1834. I am 14 years old and newly arrived in America.
The show, The Chinese Lady, is witty and profoundly sad. It premiered recently at the Barrington Stage Company in Pittsfield, Massachusetts, a co-production with New York's Ma Yi Theater. Playwright Lloyd Tsa joins us now. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And that voice we heard is actress Shannon Tayo, who portrays the Chinese lady. She joins us as well from Pittsfield. Shannon, welcome to you as well.
Happy to be here.
Lloyd, start with you. You are of Korean descent. So how did you come to this story?
I came across the story in the preface of a book about the history of Asian America. Just like a sentence about her. It sparked something in me. And I then went into kind of a deep dive, trying to research anything I could find about her, and was startled to find that there was not a lot.
When it's such an extraordinary thing, so here she is set up to be looked at by Americans in sort of a staged area where these traders put a lot of their Chinese wares that they were bringing back into the country and they wanted to sell. Shannon, you're also Korean-American. So I wondered, you know, your thoughts, first of all, on approaching this character. Could you identify with this idea of an Asian woman being looked at, almost like something in a zoo?
The interesting thing about being Asian American is we are not quite at the point where we're able to be separated out into Chinese American or Japanese American or Korean American. And in that sense, I think Asian Americans in general can very much identify with the idea of being looked at and being othered by Americans who potentially would not consider us to be American.
And in your case, you are.
Yes.
And in her case, she was not. She was something exotic. Let's listen to a little of her thoughts as written by Lloyd. She's a captive and somewhat at the mercy of her translator, A Tongue. So let's listen to a clip from that. First, A Tongue speaks.
I am A Tongue. I am...
A Tongue is irrelevant.
I am irrelevant. That's what I was going to say. I was going to say I am irrelevant.
A Tongue has been in service of Mr. Nathaniel and Frederick Carne as a manservant and translator of Chinese to English and back again. He is now assigned to me.
Tell us more about how you imagined who she was, because you give her real spunk.
Yeah, and I want to make a point of clarity that the notion of ownership is a complicated one as well. The historical assumption is that she was going to the United States as an ambassador, not in this explicitly demeaned way, but more in a way that could arguably or theoretically be conceived as this incredible opportunity to share something of her culture. And so a big part of the character's introduction is in this sense of hope. And the other part of that question is about how to even begin to imagine what the psychology or the motivations of A Fang Moy might be. as the play progresses, it becomes about the yearning of human beings to be relevant and to make a connection.
But meanwhile, most of the people who came to see her back then want to see her feet. And there's this little news clipping that you might have found in your research, you know, people talking about how she's coming and people will get to see her astonishing little feet in big capital letters. And that means, of course, she has to take her shoes off. And Shannon, I'm just wondering how you felt when your character playing Afang Moy tells the, you know, those of us who were put in the position of being the people looking at her in a, as if in a museum. She talks about, when I was 4 years old, my feet were placed into a hot mixture of herbs and animal blood to soften the skin and muscles. Bones were broken so that the foot could be bound. Your thoughts when you speak these words?
Foot binding is a really extreme example, I think, of cultural relativism. I've watched a lot of interviews with women who are alive right now who do have bound feet. And, you know, there's a lot of discussion about how it's very painful. Obviously, it alters the way that you walk for the rest of your life. But a lot of women are very proud of it because it is seen as a sign of social status. And the very interesting point that Afang makes in the play is equating it to practices in America that were seen potentially by outsiders as barbaric, such as corsets. And the very extreme example she makes is the transatlantic slave trade. So in every culture, I think there are things that are seen by outsiders to be curious at the least and barbaric at the most extreme. The important thing is to focus on the fact that Afang doesn't think it's awful. She finds it to be rather beautiful in a way.
Lloyd, did she really get up and walk around the room at different times for the people who'd come to see her?
She did, yeah. That's one of the things that seems to be consistently stated part of the routine. It's very much my hope that the play asks a contemporary audience watching it to interrogate their own assumptions about what their feelings are when they enter and what they are at the end of the play when they've spent some time with Afang Moy.
We mentioned the interpreter Atang, and there's another scene in which we see how much she relies on him in this kind of symbiotic relationship they have. It's a scene in which they recount how she met then-President Andrew Jackson, not ironically the same president responsible for the Trail of Tears that resulted in the deaths of 5,000 Native Americans. Atang translated for Afang at this presidential meeting, and it's, you can see that he sort of short-circuited everything she said. Let's listen.
I admire the American people for their boundless curiosity and fierce individuality.
American people also good, I think.
I have had the great privilege of seeing so much of America and have been performing to sizable crowds.
I am so happy. Many Americans see me.
So, Lloyd, what were you saying there again about the inability of the Chinese lady to actually be who she is?
I hope I'm saying more than one thing. I think it's a very complicated moment. There is certainly the difficulty of communication, what one hears in translation. As that scene develops, it shifts rather dramatically, both in terms of Atang's relationship with the translation, his relationship with how he's translating for her, not just from her words, but translating Jackson's words back to her.
She says, when a white person asks me a complex question such as, are you excited to tour the country? I can only say yes or yes, sir, very much. When I want to say, I cherish the opportunity like a flower cherishes sunlight, that the thought of seeing the whole of America roots in me like a jewel that's lodged inside my eyes and colors every part of my vision, then you have Atang saying, well, when she says things like that, I translate them as, she says, yes, she's excited. And then Afang says, and so these white people, they think I'm simple. I must not allow that. I must express my voice. This is my obligation to the world. So you picture the Chinese lady as somebody struggling to break out of perceptions and the museum box that she's in.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think of this notion that as Asian American theater artists, how are we seen? What do people expect from us? How do we navigate with integrity the expectation that we should perform? At what point do you begin to lose your personhood?
And also, playwright Lloyd Sa, you begin to imagine an Afong Moy, as she grows older, as someone who watches the march of history and watches the terrible things this country did to the Chinese as they came, and thinks that she's the one who failed by not winning people over to the Chinese. She speaks these words: in 1871, a mob of 500 Californians descend upon the residents of Los Angeles Chinatown. 52 Chinese Americans are injured, 20 are tortured and lynched. Perhaps if I had done things differently. Shannon, as you got to that part of your character as the play progresses?
It's heartbreaking. It was one of the things that I first connected with upon reading it, because it is such a generous act to take the blame upon herself. And just speaks to the tremendous responsibility that she felt when she first came over as a 14-year-old child, that she was going to come to America and be an ambassador, and then to come to terms with the disappointment of her expectations is heartbreaking. And this sort of history remains so unknown within the realm of American history is heartbreaking.
Yeah.
And I would hope that somebody who came to see the play would be able to relate more to these historical events, because you're being led through by this character who you've watched grow.
Here she is again. It's the year 1885. I'm 65. In Sweetwater County, Wyoming, a safe place for the Chinese is burned to the ground by a mob of 150 white men, resulting in the mutilation, decapitation, castration of 50 Chinese-American minors. Again, this history put together by playwright Lloyd Suh in his play The Chinese Lady, about a real-life young Chinese woman who was brought to the United States as a curiosity. Actor Shannon Tayo plays Afong Moy. The new production is at the Barrington Stage Company for just a little while longer. Shannon, Lloyd, thank you so much.
Thank you.
President Trump is escalating tensions with China over tariffs, threatening to increase some to 25% from a proposed 10% on $200 billion worth of Chinese imports. Because of the Chinese retaliatory tariffs, largely against Trump supporting American farmers, and now there is a new battle line in this trade war between U.S. farm groups and President Trump. A coalition called Farmers for Free Trade has just launched a $2.5 million ad campaign, which includes this anti-tariff TV spot.
Farmers, factory workers, and rural communities are feeling the pain from President Trump's trade war. But one of Trump's top trade advisors says,
the amount of trade that we're affecting with the tariffs is a rounding error.
America's farmers and factory workers are not a rounding error.
We are not a rounding error. Here you now, media analyst John Carroll is here. John, tell us more about this group.
Okay, this group, Farmers for Free Trade, is a coalition. It's a nonprofit group that's funded by the American Farm Bureau Federation and a number of different commodity groups like the American Soybean Association, the National Pork Producers Coalition. These are products that are particularly hard hit by the tariffs that Trump's imposed. It's a four-month campaign. It'll be on print. It'll be in print on TV, on radio. There'll be digital advertising. The spot we just heard is running on national cable right now.
Rounding error. Oh, boy. I'm sure someone wishes they could take that back. But there's also a whole voice of the farmer component, and that has personal stories?
Right. There's another national cable spot running that features a Pennsylvania apple orchard owner who talks about how the tariffs make things so uncertain that he really can't plan for the future. And if you go to their website, farmers are able to upload videos of themselves telling their own personal stories.
What's interesting, they may have been working on these ads, but they came out after President Trump offered that $12 billion bailout for farmers who were being harmed by this trade war, soybean farmers and such. This would be direct payments. The government would buy up excess supplies, but we're reading accounts of farmers saying they don't want that handout. Have you, though, seen any ads in support of the tariffs?
There was an ad that ran in March from the Alliance for American Manufacturing. It urged President Trump to keep his promise, protect the steel industry. It was basically looking for tariffs.
Yeah, well, but no ads recently from farmers in support of tariffs.
No, I don't think you'll see those anytime soon.
Right. Another voice we just want to say we're hearing in this anti-tariff skirmish, Ronald Reagan, a group called Republicans Fighting Tariffs, has rolled out a spot that uses clips from a 1988 Reagan radio address on free trade. Listen.
Trade is the source of our prosperity. In recent years, the trade deficit led some misguided politicians to call for protectionism, warning that otherwise we would lose jobs. But when America's total trade has increased, American jobs have also increased.
And his next line is, our peaceful trading partners are not our enemies. And over that, you see the photo of Trump with his arms crossed, ignoring Angela Merkel at the G7 summit. You know, this is aimed at Donald Trump.
Right, it is. And the last line, the kicker is, the expansion of the international economy is not a foreign invasion. It's an American triumph. And I think that goes directly to the message they're trying to send to Donald Trump, that this protectionism is the wrong way to go.
Yeah, and some of these spots are coming from the industrialist, the Koch brothers, and President Trump ignited a Twitter war with them this week because of that.
Right, he called them a total joke, but they have $400 million for this election cycle, so I don't think that's so funny.
Not funny. John Carroll, media analyst for Here Now. Thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Today marks the start of another case against Alex Jones, the founder of InfoWars. It's the second case this week in Austin, Texas. Jones is being sued for defamation for things he'd said on his media platforms. Jones hasn't appeared in court this week, but he has been on the air on his radio show.
The entire leftist deep state, the entire Foundation Combine, is launching attacks on InfoWars, the likes of which you only see before the country is tricked into invading some third world country. It's war level propaganda. But see, InfoWars has been chosen as the test case for everybody else's speech to be taken.
Jones sees the cases against him as a test of free speech. Others say his conspiracy theories are dangerous and harming innocent people. Joining us now is Jonathan Tylove, chief political reporter at The American Statesman in Austin. Jonathan, for listeners who don't know much about Alex Jones, just remind us, who is he?
Well, he came from Austin. He's a homegrown product who started on local cable access, went into talk radio, and now has a huge national, international following, about 160 radio stations, but mostly on InfoWars, which is an internet platform. And he's probably, I think, the world's or the nation's leading conspiracy theorist.
And he is in legal trouble right now because of conspiracy theories involving mass shootings like the one at Sandy Hook, like the one at Stoneman Douglas High School in Florida. Let's start with the case that was the first one this week. That was a case brought by Leonard Posner and Veronique De La Rosa.
Right.
These are the parents of Noah Posner, who was a first grader killed in the 2012 Sandy Hook shooting. What is at the heart of their case?
The heart of their case is that from the start, Alex Jones has questioned whether the shooting was a hoax, whether children actually died, and whether there was some conspiracy to create this scene in order to provide fertile ground for gun control legislation, so that it really was just a fraud. And they were sort of at the center of it because his sort of key piece of evidence was a interview that Veronique De La Rosa did with Anderson Cooper on CNN, which Jones, relying on his broadcasting expertise, said was obviously done not at the site where it purported to be, but was done in front of a blue screen, which would pretend to be at the site, but really wasn't. And so that was sort of the linchpin of his argument that this was not authentic.
And what case are they making against him?
The case they are making against him is that as a result of being accused of perpetrating this fraud, they've been subject to endless harassment, have had to move seven times, and that, in fact, a listener of Alex Jones who believed what he said stalked them and issued death threats, and she ended up being sent to prison for a few months and was instructed that on her release she can't listen to Alex Jones anymore. Mm. The case hinges on whether they came in under the statute of limitations. In Texas, you have to file a defamation claim within a year. It's been years that he's been doing that, but he kind of revisited the issue in April of 2017, in which he once again brought up the blue screen. And they're saying that if you look at that and then provide context from the years of things he said before that, you realize that he's provoked this animus toward them.
They are suing for defamation, but defamation cases are notoriously difficult to win. The plaintiffs have to show that Jones not only reported false facts, but that he did so knowingly or at least didn't take reasonable steps to verify his information. How are they going to try to do that?
Well, they've done it in a number of ways. They have an expert witness that says that it would be apparent to anybody in the industry that this was not the use of a blue screen. And there's lots of other evidence that they were actually at the scene. And they had actually a former editor of the Statesman do an exhaustive analysis, which found that there was really no effort to do any of the journalistic practices which one might use to check something, that he simply makes this stuff up. Hmm.
And what is he likely to say as his defense?
Well, there's a difference between what he says, which is that he didn't say it, which is not quite true, or what his lawyers say. What his lawyers say is that he's a polemicist, that everything he says is opinion and should be taken as opinion, that he's engages in rhetorical hyperbole. That's what people tune in for. That's what they expect. And that it would be a real blow against the First Amendment to say that it's not protected speech. So it really comes down to Alex Jones purports, if you listen to him, to be drenched in facts and investigation, and that he's, in a sense, a news organization. And what his lawyers are saying is, no, he's not a news organization. He's a guy who rants with an opinion, and that should be protected no matter how foolish or ludicrous what he's saying is.
Now, Jones's legal team will appear in court again today for a second hearing. This case is brought by Marcel Fontaine, who InfoWars
right.
incorrectly identified as the Stoneman Douglas shooter. Tell us more about this case.
Yeah, and this one's, and it's actually, he has different lawyers for each of these cases, but this one's a pretty simple one. And again, it goes back to just sort of, are they journalists or are they just conspiracy mongers? What happened was as soon as the shooting occurred, a parody Twitter account, Laguna Beach Antifa, posted a photo of Marcel Fontaine saying, speculating that he was the shooter. That ended up on 4chan, which is an anonymous site with very provocative postings and a lot of conspiracy stuff and a lot of hoax stuff. They posted it, and that InfoWars took the fact that it was on these two dubious sites as reason enough for it to repost the photo identifying him as the shooter. It didn't name him, but it had the photo and it was recognizable. And the next day, they took it down and apologized. Mm. But according to Marcel Fontaine, the damage was done, and he suffered a lot of harassment and humiliation as a result.
So these are just two of the cases against Jones. He wants
right.
them thrown out of court. Is that likely to happen?
I don't know. It would seem these are in all five of these cases. It's these anti-SLAPP laws, which are essentially laws that make it harder for people to bring sort of frivolous defamation suits that are only for the purpose of silencing people and making them pay steep legal fees to have their free speech rights. This would seem to pass the threshold, at least the one that I heard yesterday. One never knows with legal arguments whether there is some particular legal argument that appeals to a judge that may not be apparent to the lay listener. And again, I think a lot of this comes down to the statute of limitations question and whether what they have from what he said within a year is sufficient by itself, and whether it's sufficient to allow them to, you know, discover things he said previously, because he's been not quite as outspoken about it as he had been in those first few years.
What do you think is at stake when it comes to the First Amendment with these cases?
Well, I think it's this gets into a complicated terrain, because right now Alex Jones is under assault in a number of ways. YouTube has taken down, I think, five of his videos.
Facebook just took his page off.
His personal Facebook account is suspended for a month. Spotify is taking down his podcasts. So I think this is part of a broader kind of argument over fake news, such as it is. And I think it's especially complicated because Jones has sort of developed this alliance with President Trump, who also has his own penchant for conspiracy theories and making stuff up. It's hard to know where to draw the line. And I think this case may be important in terms of figuring out how you police this and what you do when you have someone like Alex Jones, who a lot of people may listen to and almost for entertainment and for the bombast, but you do have a segment of the audience that takes it as gospel and believes him when he says this is the truth.
That's Jonathan Tylove, who is chief political reporter at the American Statesman in Austin, following the multiple cases against Alex Jones of InfoWars. Jonathan, thank you.
Thanks very much.
Remember back in May when the Supreme Court struck down that federal law that effectively banned sports betting in most states? Well, all bets are now on. And this week, the NBA became the first major U.S. pro sports league to enter a partnership with a gambling partner. NBA Commissioner Adam Silver announced the deal with MGM Resorts International on Tuesday.
I think there was a recognition here that it's a leap of faith on both sides. It's a deal moderate in length, where I think we can both step back and assess as we go and see, is this working? Is this deal fair? Are we providing the consumers with the right type of experience?
Mike Pesca is here now, sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. He is with us in the studio. Hi, Mike.
Hi.
How does this deal work? What does each side get?
The NBA gets money, and MGM gets the exclusive rights to use NBA licensing and NBA branding. And also, and this is a little more subtle, there is what will become a popular form of betting, which is not just betting on the outcome of the game before the game, but during the game as it's playing. You should be able to bet on. The technology is there. You could bet on who will make the next free throw or who will have the next assist. And without real-time streaming statistics, it's hard, if not impossible, to do this. So this allows MGM to offer what in Europe on soccer is a more popular form of betting. Now, we should also say that the significance of the NBA getting money is from the states. Once betting was legalized by the government, the states have to give the NBA money by giving 1% of all wagers, which is called the VIG among gamblers for vigorish, but the NBA chooses to brand this as an integrity fee, which is like the greatest example of, it's almost as if, you know, you were saying, oh, it's not a shakedown, it's term life insurance. But they have a source of income from the states and from the gamblers, but they also want to have the source of income from the casinos. And I think the league being in concert with the casinos makes it a bit more legitimate. That's what Adam Silver hopes.
Remind us what you think about this, because of course it was always thought, okay, betting, that means that players are going to be coerced into throwing games or
yes.
whatever.
Right.
What do you
right.
think?
I think not. I think that's an old way of thinking about it. I think players are making so much money that there's no way that gamblers can get to them. It's not like the 19 Chicago White Sox where they were getting underpaid by Mr. Wrigley. But I think that Adam Silver has been at the forefront of being progressive on this, and he was the one league commissioner who embraced it, and this is the way the future is going. I'm sure I've read a lot of research about gambling addiction, and there will be victims of this because gambling always has with it this side effect, and yet at the same time, it'll be a huge moneymaker and make even boring regular season games interesting.
Okay. All the leagues are going to do this, you think?
I think it's inevitable. I think this is where the tide is turning, and I think the NCAA will too.
Okay, let's turn to what some are calling a culture war in sports. LeBron James, in his interview with CNN's Don Lemon on Monday, in which LeBron James, spoke of President Trump.
He's dividing us, and what I noticed over the last few months, that he's kind of used sport to kind of divide us, and that's something that I can't relate to, because I know that sport was the first time I ever was around someone white, and I got an opportunity to see them and learn about them, and they got an opportunity to learn about me, and we became very good friends, and I was like, oh, wow, this is all because of sports.
First of all, I thought that was fascinating insight, you know, that for him to say that was the first time he interacted with whites. But your thought on this moment in time and a president and athletes and LeBron James?
I think that this was remarkable for how unremarkable it was, how eminently defensible. Everything that LeBron James was saying was, but we're not used, or we haven't been used to this sort of athlete. I'm not even going to call it activism. I'm just going to call it plain speaking. And maybe, I don't know exactly what people's perceptions of LeBron James are on these matters, but you know, it wasn't more than a few years ago, there was an academic study on him. And the conclusion is, and they looked at all the sorts of politics he's ever weighed in on, we found James is cautious and deliberate in his activism, moderating a message of consideration rather than revolution, contextualized by his brand and ambitions. And I don't think that's untrue. So if people are saying, oh, this was a radical statement, I think it's actually a moderate statement.
Also worth pointing out that President Trump has 53 million followers on Twitter. LeBron James has 41 million followers on Twitter. I mean, they're pretty close. LeBron's got a big following. There are questions about whether he's going to run for president.
Well, he's already the king. I don't know. Would that be a step down?
No, but in 2020, I mean, this is something that he's thought about. What do you think?
I think that's far-fetched. I think LeBron needs to be the greatest basketball player in the world,
with
using a platform occasionally weighing into other matters.
I just want to ask you quickly, a member of Coach Urban Meyer's, Ohio State's Urban Meyer's coaching staff, has been accused of abuse. The wife of the accused abuser says Myers knew. What's happening briefly here?
Yeah, so this was more than an accusation. I think it's a quite credible accusation. The assistant coach, Zach Smith, was fired. And the big question is, did Urban Meyer know about it? That's why Ohio State put him on leave. And there are Title IX implications. And as an employee, as a term of his contract, and as an employee of a public university, and by far the highest paid Ohio employee, the state of Ohio pays Urban Meyer more than anyone else. He might have a duty to have reported this, if indeed it can be proved that he knows. I don't know if he'll miss any games in the football season. He's still correctly considered one of the best coaches in college football.
There you go.
Mike Pesca here now, sports analyst and editor of the new book, Upon Further Review, The Greatest What-Ifs in Sports History. Thanks, Mike.
You're welcome.
Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.